Good afternoon. I would like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, April 14th, and let the record reflect it is 1 p.m. And I have myself, Chair Vance, sitting here waiting for committee members to begin. I will now take a brief at ease as we wait till they shall say in. Record reflect, we've been joined by Representative Groh, Representative Gray, Vice Chair Allard. We have a quorum to conduct business. The staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Kelsey Riker with the Juno LAO. Thank you for your work. On today's agenda, the committee will hear SB 80, the 2023 Revisers Bill from Senate Rules by request of the Legislative Council. The second item will bring back House Bill 28, Access to Marijuana Conviction Records by Representative Wright in its third hearing. And then the last item on today's agenda, we will consider three of the governor's appointees to boards and commissions. We have been joined by Representative Johnson. Welcome. So we will now hear SB 80, 2023 Revisers Bill from Senate Rules, from the Senate Rules by request of the Legislative Council. I'd like to welcome to the table Senator Gray Jackson and from Legislative Legal Services, Ms. Catherine Kurtz. If you could please put your name on the record and begin walking the committee through this bill. But before you do that, we have been joined by Representative Eastman.
Senator L.V. Gray Jackson. Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Allard, and members of the committee. The draft legislation was reviewed and approved by the Legislative Council on February 21, 2023. Senate Bill 80, it was introduced by the Senate Rules Committee by request of the Legislative Council. And as Chair of the Legislative Council, it is my honor to carry this legislation here in House Judiciary Committee. Its purpose is to clean up the statutes without making any policy changes. It's just a housekeeping bill, Madam Chair. Some sections of the bill amend provisions that have become obsolete due to other legislative action. Some sections correct drafting errors or oversights in previous legislation. But most of the errors corrected in this bill were discovered by legislative drafters or the reviser in reviewing the statutes. This bill was reviewed by the executive branch before it was introduced. The Department of Law has identified no legal issues with the bill, and it supports these proposed amendments to the Alaska state statutes. In conclusion, Madam Chair, I would be remiss if I didn't extend my gratitude to the team at LEDS Legal, especially the reviser and assistant reviser who are charged with this responsibility. And as a matter of record, each of us have 12,819 pages of Alaska state statutes in our offices. I salute Hillary Martin, the reviser, and Catherine Kurtz, the assistant reviser who is here with us today, and each of their colleagues in legal services who review these pages with great care and expertise. On behalf of the Legislative Council, I would appreciate your support for the 2023 Revisers Bill. With your indulgence, Madam Chair, Ms. Kurtz would like to offer brief remarks about the Revisers Bill, and she's prepared to walk the committee through the sectional analysis. She is also the subject matter expert who can answer technical questions about the Revisers Bill and the Alaska state statutes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Please continue.
Chair Vance, Vice Chair Allard, for the record, my name is Catherine Kurtz. I'm an assistant reviser of statutes with the Legislative Affairs Agency. And as Senator Gray Jackson explained, the Revisers Bill is an important tool for maintaining our Alaska statutes in good order. The reviser can clean up some issues on her own under the authority of AS 0105031, but her powers there are limited to editing and revising without changing the meaning of any statute. The Revisers Bill presented here is our opportunity to address issues that require something more. They can still be recorded as technical, as not affecting policy, but we're adding and deleting words, repealing obsolete paragraphs and subsections, changing references to federal law to reflect renumbering by the federal government. And these sorts of changes go into the revisers bill so that they can go through the process and where they can be easily seen by the public and by the legislature. In the interest of using your time wisely, I wasn't planning on walking through the sectional summary, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for members on SB 80? Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. Can you explain to me, just for clarification, how come you didn't want to go through the sectional summary?
Oh, just for in the interest of time, and I know that you have it in your packets, if you would like me to read through it, I can do that. Okay.
Educate me a little bit.
Certainly. Let's start then with section one. The first two sections are related. For a long time in AS 04-16-047A, we've had this reference to alcohol under 04-16-160. And when you look at 04-16-160, it uses the term alcoholic beverages, which is more consistent with usage throughout Title IV. Then, when the alcohol bill passed last session, I'm on Section 2 now, we actually managed to add another subsection using that same term, alcohol, instead of alcoholic beverages. So this is a fine point, but it's just clearer to use the same term in as we do in the section that's being referred to. So that's the rationale for that change. Section 3 is an issue that was discovered by one of our new drafting attorneys, and it's a reference to magnetic tape. We're not changing anything about the information that's required to be provided, but this person who has graduated from law school more recently than I, shall we say, looked at that and went, magnetic tape? It's an old format. We checked with the court system. They do not, they support this change. That's an example of an obsolete provision. In Section 4, it's simply changing the letter K to the word kindergarten, which is ideally something that would have been done in the drafting process, but, you know, that one got missed somehow, and to say the whole word is clearer. In Section 5, this publication used to be called the Near Drowning Guidelines. It's not anymore. We're updating it to call it what the Department of Health actually calls the guidelines now, so that people can find them more easily. 2605-170, this is an older statute, and it's got a reference to the military department of the state. Subsequently, a definition of department was added that applies to this section, and that department is the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. So in this case, it's clear to take those extra words out and just say department because it's a defined term. In Section 7, that is a change to a federal reference. The federal government moved their law, renumbered it. I looked at it. Nothing else changed that affects the content. It's just a renumbering of the federal law, except as noted in the sectional summary, when it was reclassified, references to this title were replaced with references to this chapter so that the federal law would continue to make sense, but what's being referred to didn't change. Section 8 in each of the designs replaces both of the designs because I believe there are now three possibilities in that section. Yes, they added a third license plate design. Periods of limitation before or after September 7th, 1986. That's in Section 9. Obviously, that date is long gone. So rather than clutter things up with it, we're recommending removal of that date. Highways equipment. Here, we just had a disconnect in the name of the fund. We want this section, similarly to Section 1, we want this to correspond to the section it's referring to. There in 4468-210, the fund is named the Highways Equipment Working Capital Fund. So we're changing highway to highways equipment to match. Again, we strive hard not to change the meaning of anything, but we are changing words. And we want a record of that, that people can see. So if they're wondering, well, how did that happen? They can see it. December 16th of each year, that's a clarification in Section 11 because it refers to an annual report. There are several sections that refer to the Alaska Coastal Management Program, which was repealed a number of years ago. That was a sunset provision. Not everything was anticipated at the time the sunset was drafted. So this is clean up, removing references to coastal districts, coastal services, areas, things that no longer exist. Section 18 is another reference to federal law, to United States Code, where the federal statute has been renumbered. So we've updated that to show the statute's current numbering. Section 19, defining the term wildland fire. This is the repealer section. The term wildland fire is no longer used in the statutes, so it doesn't make sense to have a definition for the term any longer. Veteran. There was a definition of veteran in 2610-060B because the term veteran was removed from that section and is not used in the federal statute or the Alaska Administrative Code. We believe that definition is also obsolete. And finally, 4117-900B2. And the text of these statutes being repealed is on the last page of the sectional summary. That third one is another reference to the Alaska Coastal Management Program. It requires consistency with that program. And since that whole program has been repealed, it does not make sense to have paragraph B2 any longer with the reference to coastal management. An effective date for the whole bill is the immediate effective date. Well, we have a special effective date in Section 20. That relates to Section 2 of the bill, which is amending a section added in the alcohol bill last year. Most of that bill won't take effect until January 1 of 2024, next year. So this is just a delayed effective date for Section 2. So that happens the day that subsection takes effect. So that was my turbo sectional explanation. Any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Kurtz. Thank you. That through the chair, that prevents any questions from me. So thank you.
Through the chair, thank you for your time.
I do have a question on Section 9.
Yes.
You removed the before or after September 7th, 1986, and the words after that says a period of time specified by contract. And I'm thinking about the submerged lands bill that the phrase a period of time in regards to statehood was changed, and it now says the date. So is there a reason that you chose not to use the phrase the date specified by contract and chose a period of time in this particular section?
In this particular section of a period of time is already there. So that factored into this recommended change. But, you know, one thing I didn't say at the outset that I'd like to add now is that if any of these provisions cause concern or you think they make a substantive difference, then it is my error, and thank you for noticing it. It could certainly be removed from the bill if you believe it makes a substantive change or if it makes any sort of a change that goes beyond the simple housekeeping. So I had not, I think you're suggesting a different wording, which is not what I have there. It's possible that it could be done differently. And if that would be preferred, we could certainly do that. Or we would be happy to omit that section from the bill, and it could be addressed in a substantive bill.
The reason that the language is in the submerged lands bill with those particular changes, when we asked the question of legal, it said that it made it more succinct, if I remember correctly, instead of saying a period of time, because the attorney on the line said that a period of time was more vague than the date, which so I'm not trying to change meaning, but just simply be in a line with the thought process from legislative legal, and I didn't know if there was a reason that that was not that most recent thought process was not included in this particular section. And I can give you more time to reflect on that. Do we have any other questions from committee members? Representative Eastman.
Even through the chair. Is it your contention that Senate Bill 80 complies with the single subject rule?
No, but through the chair, there is an exception to the single subject rule for budget bills and for revisers bills.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair. And which of the exemptions listed in Section 13 of Article 2 do you think that the Senate Bill 80 qualifies under?
I think it qualifies under the exceptions for revisers bills, for bills revising the statutes. And I apologize for not having the Constitution memorized or in my hands at this moment, but I'm quite confident that is an exception to the single subject rule.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
And so, kind of also listening to what you were saying earlier, is it your contention that if a law is no longer being followed, that it can be eliminated without causing any substantive change to law?
Through the chair, our statutory assignment is to address obsolete provisions in the statute.
Follow up. And how do we understand obsolete? Is there a definition somewhere, or what do you take it to mean?
Well, I think the examples in this bill are illustrative of how I interpret that term. This date, for example, that we were just looking at is past. Other examples, if we look at the first page of the sectional, it identifies sections that delete, repeal, or update obsolete provisions. The magnetic tape, for example, that is something where the format is simply not in common usage any longer. So there is a requirement to do something that's not technically... I don't want to say not feasible, but it is requiring what is an obsolete format for the transfer of information. That was probably quite current when that provision was written. But since it is no longer how information is commonly transmitted, that is why I believe that particular provision is obsolete. Through the chair, I'm not sure that addresses your question.
Sure, that's helpful. Very much follow up. And I'm thinking back to bills that we've run in previous legislatures dealing with. One bill that I think this committee dealt with was, there was something in statute that APOC had to have offices in every Senate district, and that had never actually happened, and so a bill was needed to clean that up and get rid of that requirement, which was arguably not very feasible, and funding wasn't provided, that sort of thing. I'm just wondering if there's the opportunity to do that sort of cleanup through a revisor's bill, why do we have to go through the process of bills like that?
Through the chair, we try to be extremely conservative in what we do with the revisers bill, and it's really directed at cleaning up the statutes. This is a housekeeping bill, and I can't speak directly to the bill you're referring to, having not looked at that, or not recently anyway. But that sort of issue goes beyond what one person can recommend. As you've already noted, there is an exception to the single subject rule here. So this is a very special type of bill, and we really want to try and keep it limited. to corrections that come within our statutory mandate to delay, repeal, or update obsolete provisions, correct errors and oversight, and improve the form or substance of the law. Now, I think the suggestion may be that there are other obsolete provisions in the statute, or as noted, there are certainly things in the Alaska statutes that are not funded, but that falls into the category of a policy choice for the legislature. I can't make a call about that. Things might be funded in the future. That, I think, is beyond what we're attempting to do in the revisers' bill. So we can't fix all of the problems in the statutes, but I am hoping that we can fix these issues in this bill.
Follow up.
Do you have questions regarding the specifics of this?
Sure. And I guess my first question on that would be through the chair. Of the revisers bills you worked on, have you previously worked on a bill that dealt with a compound effective date where one portion of the bill is taking one effective date and another portion is taking a different effective date?
Through the chair, I want to make sure I understand what you mean by compound effective date. Are you referring to a situation as in this bill where you have an immediate effective date and then a specific effective date applying to a different section?
That would qualify, yeah.
Have I dealt with a revisor's bill that presented that? I honestly don't remember.
Okay. Follow up. And I just wanted to understand exactly why that, you know, complex effective date is required. What is going on in Section 2 that, as we're doing this housekeeping, it wouldn't be appropriate to make that effective immediately, along with the rest of the bill? And I'm trying to square, if it's just housekeeping and it's not changing law, why couldn't we just do it immediately?
Through the chair, because the section that the change is being made to has not yet taken effect, so it would be incongruous to have a change take effect before the actual subsection takes effect. So the reason that's there and the reason that introductory language in Section 2 is there is to alert everyone to the fact that it is changing a portion of the code that has not actually taken effect yet and won't take effect until the first of next year. So it's to make the change align with the effective date of the subsection.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you, Ms. Kurtz. I know you haven't had a moment to reflect on Section 9 in my question, but let me ask it this way. And I apologize for putting you on the spot because I didn't see this particular section and think of it as with the other bill and the changes with the recommendations by legislative legal until now. If we were to change the words period of time to date, would it change the meaning? Because in my mind, it would say of a date specified by contract, statute, or court order, and it is not my intent to change the meaning, but to be in alignment with the recommendations from legislative legal. Do you feel that that would be appropriate and would not change the intent of these words?
Madam Chair, I appreciate the desire to phrase statutes succinctly to the extent possible. I'm a little bit concerned about changing the words period of time, which might encompass multiple days. It could be months, it could be a period of years, to the word date. So the expiration of a date specified by contract, statute, or court order sounds like we're looking for January 1, 2024, or a specific date, whereas the expiration of a period of time specified by contract is a little bit broader. So just off the cuff, I'm not quite comfortable making that additional change. But once again, this is not the only bill. And if there's attention needed here, it could be addressed in a substantive bill.
Well, I appreciate that. And as you know, that part of this process is to prove our intent on the record and clarifying the reason that we have that and not the other is part of the purpose in me asking the question. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, to the chair. I want to speak a little bit about this issue with the period of time. When we were discussing it in the previous bill, I think it did make sense to change it to date. But because the word expiration appears before a period of time, it says, you know, the expiration of a period of time specified by contract, statute, or court order. And another committee that I'm on, we've been talking a lot about 180 days or whatever is longer. And so I could see how if somewhere in statute it's referring to 180 days as a period of time, and we change it to a date, it wouldn't make sense in that case. So I'm just drawing that as an example of where I think period of time might apply in certain cases where a date wouldn't.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. What would the significance be if we remove Section 7 from the bill?
Then the reference would remain at 50 U.S.C. App 459, and the reader of the statutes would be left to locate the relevant law.
Follow up. And if that law has been repealed and there's a reference to it in our statute, does the repealed law and all of that it's requiring happen still attach? Or because it's been repealed and it's no longer in the U.S. code, would the fact that it's been repealed impact our how it applies here in Alaska?
Through the chair, that question is a hypothetical that I don't feel prepared to offer a definitive answer to today. The two changes to USC sites in this bill, I feel very confident recommending because I've reviewed the language and I recognize them as numbering issues. There may be references to USC provisions that have been repealed because the federal law develops through the federal system independent of Alaska law. So it is possible that there is a reference to a federal law that has been repealed. And I would say if you're aware of that, that is something that the reviser would appreciate knowing in case there is a fix that can be recommended. But I can't speculate on the effect of the repeal of a federal statute that's referred to in state law without more. I can say that we're not solving every issue with references to the United States Code in this particular bill. But, yeah.
Follow up? So are you drawing a distinction then between if the federal law changes, they repeal one section, they move it to another section, versus if they repeal it and don't move it to another section? Do you think that that's legally significant for purposes of Alaska law?
Through the chair, I believe it's significant for the reader of the Alaska statutes, if they're going to find the language that was in place when the statute was adopted, when the statute was enacted, if there is a reference to federal law and the text of the federal law has been moved to one place, from one place to another in the United States Code, which is the compilation of the federal statutes, I believe it's useful to the reader to direct them to the spot where it currently appears. But, which is what these two provisions do.
Thank you. Follow up?
One more follow up.
Yeah, I think I only have one left. And it was just, I can understand from a librarian's perspective or a historian's perspective, you know, it's helpful to have that clue to what existed previously, might be harder to find. But my question is more, you know, kind of to the attorney, from the attorney's perspective, is it legally significant when we have something in our statute, which refers to a federal code, which I'm opposed to, I think, in every case that I'm aware of, where that statute no longer exists at the code previously. Is that legally significant, or is that not legally significant?
Through the chair, because these are... You earlier asked whether there's a distinction between a federal statute that has been repealed and a federal statute that has been renumbered. Am I correct in rephrasing that previous
yes.
question? Yes, I believe for purposes of this bill, there is a distinction. And here, the two examples presented are instances where the federal statute has been relocated. I'm not comfortable speculating about the effect of the repeal of a particular federal statute that has not been renumbered because it's outside the framework of the recommendations in this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Kurtz. Seeing no other questions from committee members, I'm now going to open public testimony on SB 80. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify in SB 80? Please rush forward. All right. Seeing none, I do not see anyone online. I am now closing public testimony in SB 80. SB 80 is now before the committee, and we have received no amendments. Does the bill sponsor have any closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you and the rest of the committee for hearing this housekeeping bill, and I really appreciated the questions that were asked. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ms. Kurtz, for indulging us on our questions and for mine just simply for the legislative record and our intent. Do I have a motion, Representative Carpenter?
We have a discussion on the bill?
My apologies, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting. I remember a few years back when I served with Ledge Council and we had a related revisers bill come before us and a lot of discussion over what could be in the bill, what couldn't be in the bill, and the reference to the state constitution that I mentioned earlier came up. What I understood from some of those conversations was we have a specific exemption in our constitution to the single subject rule so that if we're renumbering things or just moving things around, moving one statute from one title to another title, then the Constitution really doesn't, have anything to say about that being bad or not being able to do that. It could be about 55 different subjects and the single subject rule wouldn't apply. But just listening to the conversation today, I'm hearing about housekeeping and how housekeeping, isn't really that substantive and maybe that should also fall under the single subject exemption. But when I pull out the Constitution, I don't see housekeeping on the list of things that is exempted from the single subject rule. And actually, I think a large number of the bills that have come across my desk, even some of the ones that I've written, have dealt with housekeeping. Just bringing statutes up to date or removing things that were antiquated or overly onerous. Or we had a bill on the floor this morning dealing with something back with 1989 that's out of date and needed to be updated. And I think the legislature kind of deals with that all the time. I'm exquisitely concerned that this understanding of housekeeping is now sort of potentially being added to how the legislature might deal with things that aren't related to one subject. I think if it was just one subject, you can have as many housekeeping things as you like, and I don't think the Constitution would have anything to say about that. But I think when you have multiple subjects in a single bill, when you bring housekeeping into it, I think the single subject rule does have something to say about that. So I'm concerned.
Thank you, Representative Eason. Any other comments from committee members? Representative Carpenter, may I have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 80, version 33-LS0303/S from committee with attached fiscal notes.
I'll get.
There has been an objection. Would the recorder please tally the roll?
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Representative Eastman?
No.
Representative Gray?
Yes.
Representative Groh?
Yes.
Yes.
5 yeas, 1 nay.
By a vote of 1 nay and 5 yeas, SB 80 has moved from committee. And I just want to thank the senator once again. We will take a brief at ease as we transition to the next bill. Back on the record, we will now bring back House Bill 28, Access to Marijuana Conviction Records, by Representative Wright in its third hearing. There is a new committee substitute before us. Representative Johnson, may I have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the House Judiciary Committee adopt a new committee substitute for HB 28, version 33, LS027/S, as a committee working document.
Object for discussion.
Thank you. I would now like to invite my Chief of Staff, Jake Almeida, to the table to explain the changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jake Almeida, Chief of Staff to Rep. Vance and Committee 8 to the House Judiciary Committee. This is a very brief explanation of changes, which is why I did not prepare a sheet before you. The only changes made in the new version of version S compared to that of version Alpha can be found on page 3, line 5. By request of the chair, we added a new subsection, pays a fee established by the agency in regulation in an amount that is not less than $150. And then we also removed section 5, prior court records, that allowed some flexibility for the court system and how they would implement this bill. That is not legally necessary language, according to Legislative Legal Services, so we removed it. And again, the small subsection 5 on line 5 is a policy call by the chair. Those are the changes.
Thank you, Mr. Almeida. Do we have any questions from committee members? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, how did we come up with the figure $150?
I researched what other states have done for marijuana conviction records, and the range was $150 to $500. And I took the low ball figures because of the hardship of people trying to find jobs, and also wanted them to have, because this is essentially a big ask to have their prior convictions sealed, that they have to show that this is serious and that they're willing to help pay for the associated costs. It is also my intent that the fiscal note, when this bill moves to finance, can be considered to have a significant reduction because of the fact that the people making the request will be paying what could be considered a user fee.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Eastman, do you maintain your objection?
I withdraw my objection.
Thank you. The committee substitute for SB 80 has now been adopted. Excuse me, SB 28. HB 28. Wow, it was SB 80, but it's HB 28. My apologies to the recorder. Okay, Representative Wright, would you like to make any closing comments on your bill?
For the record, Representative Wright, House District 22. Thank you, Madam Chair, and esteemed colleagues. I do appreciate you all putting this through its paces and giving it an opportunity to move forward. And thank you. I know that's our job to make sure we ensure a good product comes forth, and this is good legislation. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wright. Do we have any closing comments or any final comments from committee members? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. I remember a discussion that came up in a prior hearing and that dealt with the line 21 of page 3 now in the CS. And that it talks about once we've said this information is going to be available, there's going to be it looks like a public notice about how you get to the information that we just removed. And I remember there being a little bit of confusion over whether or not that was extraneous, since we just disappeared that information, if we're now telling them they can go and get it some other way. I'm just wondering if where does that stand? What is the effect of that now? Is there another way to get that information? And if so, what is that other way? Or did we successfully remove public access to that information, in which case there wouldn't be any other place to go and get that information?
Representative Eastman, I'm trying to understand your question here.
So on line 19, we've told the court system elsewhere in the bill that this information is not going to be publicly available, at least not under any normal means. And I'm not talking about law enforcement access, because that continues. And in on line 21, we're telling the court system they need to post on their website how to get the information that's no longer publicly available and that's not on their website. And I'm just wondering, is there in fact a way for them to do that? Is there another way for people to get that information so that the court can comply with the law and post that, you know, how to do that? Or were we successful in making it not public, in which case the court would not be able to follow that requirement?
Representative Eastman, I believe on line 9 that we were very clear on what we told the court system to do as far as the publicly available information. The only other information removed in the CS was not required by law, mm-hmm. which we just voted to adopt.
So what do we do on line 21 then?
I believe Ms. Mead previously spoke to this on how the court's website addresses this issue.
My takeaway from what she had said in committee was that this information isn't going to be available, so they're not going to put that on the website, that you can go and get information that you actually can't get. Now, I might be confused, but that was my takeaway.
Brief it is. Back on the record. And for clarification, I was just answering a question of prior committee meetings that were addressing some of the questions that had come up. But we are under closing comments at this time. And Representative Eastman, I did interrupt your closing comment. I want to let you finish before we
Thank you.
Allow other members.
Yeah, no, and I regret that it's possible this section wasn't caught up in the CS, and maybe further committee could deal with that. But I think the two outstanding issues with the CS right now that stand out to me are the language on line 21, 22 of page 3, I think might be sending someone down a I don't know what the appropriate term is, but a loop that never ends as they go to find information that actually isn't there to find. And then also on line 16 of page 3, the current language in the bill is, you know, was not convicted of any other criminal charges in that case. And I know the discussion earlier revolved around not just were they not convicted of something else, but were they actually charged with other crimes, in which case this conviction might have been a result of a plea bargain, in which case, of course, they weren't convicted of other crimes because this was the conviction that, you know, was the result of the plea bargain. And I know that there was some concern from members of the public over whether are we dealing with people who were, this was the only crime that they were, you know, charged with, that they committed, that, you know, is now being treated specially, or was this just one of potentially numerous crimes that they were charged with. This is just the one that ended up, you know, with the conviction tag to it. So I think those two items probably bear more attention as this bill goes forward.
Thank you. Any other closing remarks? Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say very briefly, I once again applaud the work of the sponsor. I'm proud to be a co-sponsor. I do retain a concern about the cost that we're charging the people involved, and maybe that can be addressed somewhere else. But I'm going to be in a amending vote on this based on that. But I definitely applaud the work on this bill. Thank you.
Any further closing comments? Representative Johnson, do I have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House Judiciary Committee move the committee substitute for HB 2833-LS0271 /S from committee with attached physical notes and give Legislative Legal Services permission to make all technical and conforming changes necessary.
Hearing no objection, committee substitute for House Bill 28 has moved from committee, and we will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back on the record. On our final agenda item today is to hear from the governor's appointees on three different boards and commissions. We will first take up the appointee to the Alaska Judicial Council, Mr. Denny DeWitt. Mr. DeWitt, if you could please come to the table, place your name on the record, and begin your opening remarks. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Dennis DeWitt. I'm honored by the governor's appointment to the Alaska Judicial Council. My wife, Patsy, and I live here in Juneau. Two of our children and their spouses, four of our grandchildren live here as well. First arrived in Juneau in 1980, was outside from mid-86 to 91, and have been here back in Juneau ever since. I'm a graduate of Sacramento State College in 1970 with a major in government, a minor in economics. I've worked in or around government most of my career. In Alaska, I've been the director of the Division of Pioneer Benefits, special assistant to Governor Murkowski, legislative staff, including 4 years lead staff on the House operating budget. As staff to the House Finance Committee, I became familiar with the court's budget, including the Alaska Judicial Council. In addition, I have served as a lobbyist and an association manager. I believe my background prepares me well for the responsibilities of a member of the Alaska Judicial Council. My responsibilities include the ability to listen, review pertinent information, remember the diversity of our state, and make fair recommendations on judicial applications. Thank you for your consideration. Be happy to respond as you might want me to.
Thank you, Mr. DeWitt. Do we have any questions from members? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chait, for coming here in person. Always nice to be able to put a name to a face and see somebody across the table as opposed to on the phone. No offense to those who can't make it, of course. But I was curious, the position that you are appointed to, the Judicial Council, is that an at-will position? Can the governor appoint someone new in your place at any time that he wants, do you know?
I do not believe it is. It's a 6-year term, and I do not believe it's at-will.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
And how do you see your appointment? Are you on the council on behalf of the governor, or if there's a new governor, on behalf of the new governor, or are you representing a particular entity? How do you philosophically see your role?
Through the chair, I see my role as a representative of the people of Alaska. My philosophy is this little operation that we're all involved in called state government belongs to the people. I think the governor chose me because I believe that strongly, and I think he has that same philosophy. I don't believe I've been appointed to specifically represent a governor or any other individual.
Thank you very much.
Mr. DeWitt, we had conversations just getting to know kind of your basic thought of the council and your role, and you mentioned about just representing the people, and I appreciate that perspective. But would you expound on that idea and really, you know, just the role of the council as a whole in light of the people? Because in conversations, you know, just people tend to make it out to be very political. But your position, as you mentioned, is to represent the people. Would you continue to talk about that? Because I really appreciated hearing your heart of what this role entails. And I think it's appropriate for the public to hear that.
Thank you. Well, let me start by suggesting that there's nothing that's non-political. But I believe that as a member of a council, one of the things that's important is that the council itself and myself be as transparent as possible, be as open as possible, and help folks get a look into why we do things, what we do, and how we do them. I know that there are groups of folks time to time who have real concerns about how the Judicial Council functions. I think they've, over the last few years, begun to look at whether or not they need to be in executive session for some of the things that they traditionally went into. My notion is that the more we can do outside of executive session, the better. The more sunshine, the more openness, transparency that we can offer citizens of Alaska, the better. There are certainly going to be things that need to be handled in executive session when you're considering people and appointments. But the more you can do and express to people openly, I think the better kind of government we have, the more support and confidence we'll have in our actions. We have a vast state with tremendous diversity. I think it's important that we recognize that, and that we are attentive to needs and concerns that have been articulated by whatever groups or groupings or people. Sometimes you can accommodate, sometimes no is an answer. Those are the kinds of decisions that will be before me, and I'll have to make those based on my belief of what is in the best interest of Alaskans generally.
Thank you, Mr. DeWitt. Any further questions from committee members? Representative Gray.
Thank you. To the chair, thank you so much for being here, Mr. DeWitt, and thank you for coming and meeting in person in my office. I was one of the things that we discussed was a feeling that the way the governor, when he's presented with a list of nominees for judgeships, that list is too narrow. Can you talk a little bit about wanting to expand the list of nominees that the governor is given to choose for judges?
Certainly, through the chair. I think the common wisdom, and since I have not sat through the totality of a selection process, I will refer to the common wisdom, which is what we all have to live with, is that the Judicial Council, and this is probably a little extreme, but I think it's the sense of it. If you rate someone on a rating of 1 to 5, for example, and you have 2 fives, which is the minimum that you have to send to the governor, and 2 4.75s. Typically, many believe that the Judicial Council will send the 2 fives. I would probably be inclined to send all five of them. I think that the notion that one or two people are the very best and the only nominees probably is difficult to justify. On the other hand, if we had two fives and two twos, I'd probably be inclined to send the two fives or vote to send the two fives. So I think there's some room to expand who we send. I tend to be open to more inclusion rather than less inclusion.
Any further questions for Mr. DeWitt? Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. DeWitt, do you have thoughts on the current judicial selection process?
Through the chair, I think generally it's a good one.
And follow up? And why do you think so?
I lived in states that, through the chair, excuse me, I've lived in states that elect justices, judges, particularly in the reading that I've done since the governor has appointed me. It's hard to argue that a thoughtful process, which is what I think we have, is in any way inferior to judges out campaigning that, you know, I'll rule this way or I'll rule that way. Or from my perspective, and I've seen it happen many times, where a judge is following the Constitution and the law, and whether that judge likes it or not gets him to an unpopular decision. And in a free and open election, as California has, for example, the judge suffers for that. I think that hurts the judiciary and the judicial process over time.
Thanks a lot, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Mr. DeWitt, for coming before us today and for taking time to meet us and answer so many of our questions. We appreciate you being here today.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
We will now take up the appointee to the Commission on Judicial Conduct, Mr. Todd Fletcher. Mr. Fletcher,
yes.
If you could please
I'm here.
State your name for the record and begin telling us about yourself.
Okay. My name is Todd Fletcher. I am one of the citizen members on the Board of Judicial Conduct. I've served my first term. I've really enjoyed it. I'm born and raised in Alaska. I'm an Eagle Scout. I think it has been a very interesting time on the board, being able to have citizens, judges, and then also attorneys, I think really gives a very good rounded ability when we're taking a look at the ethics of how things are handled in areas that possibly need to be looked at to make sure there's not continued issues in any situation or with a particular judge, and really just the conversations that take place in helping determine things. I think it is a really great commission. So I really enjoy being on the commission and being able to, you know, help our judicial system remain strong and also improve. So, born and raised in Alaska. I've been married almost 30 years. I've got two kids in college. I'm a financial advisor and a manager for the wealth management side of Wells Fargo Advisors. And just that's about it for me.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher. Do we have any questions from committee members? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher. Through the chair, I mean, my question is dealing very much with the role of the commission itself. And as an appointee, do you have the courage to, in essence, tell a judge when they're behaving badly? I mean, I know very few people want to be in that situation, much less want to tell a judge, you were wrong in a particular case. Do you have the courage to do that?
Absolutely. And I will tell you, that is something that I think really leads to the importance of this commission, is the conversations that take place. The judges are held to higher standards. The attorneys are held to higher standards. And I feel for us as citizen members of the committee, we are there to make sure that those standards are kept high. And then also when we go in and we look at the different ways that you can let a judge know or how the process needs to be addressed, I think it's a very good process. I mean, it really serves the whole public. I think it serves the state of Alaska, and I think it serves the judicial institution. And I have no problem. Like I said, I'm an Eagle Scout. I mean, there is the truth, and then there's ways that things need to be addressed. And I have no problem addressing that. And I think having judges, attorneys, and citizen members, we can really come to the best way to address that situation and make sure that if something needs to be addressed, it does get addressed.
Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Fletcher. My question is about the increasing politicization that we see of judges across the country. It seems that the judiciary nationwide is a very heated political topic at the moment. And I'm wondering if you could comment on if any of that is affecting your ability to do your work on the council. I know that there's a lot of folks out in the public, sometimes, well, not a lot, some people who say that our judiciary is very corrupt. And I wonder if you have pressure from the public to find corruption.
I will tell you that I've had two people from the public contact me and question things. And I think when you serve on a commission or a board, whether that is a public board, a private board, a state board, you will get questioned. And I think that is something that's another thing where we need to hold ourselves to a high standard to make sure that even those that call or those that don't call, they can have confidence in the system that is being done. And there are conversations that we have in regards to the political climate that is out there right now. And that is one thing that has to be done, is making sure that there is no bias. So we have to make sure that when decisions are get made, when a judge is being questioned, and even the way that our board works, that things have to be done where there is no bias, and the outside political situation that is out there would not affect the way that things are done. So it is very important that we are an unbiased committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fletcher. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Fletcher, for putting yourself out here in this public process, and thank you for your service. I'm curious to know if you are could characterize or can summarize what the judiciary's responsibility is with regard to grand juries.
Well, I will tell you that is something that has really just started to come into play in regards to discussions that are out there. And I think that's something that's going to need to be discussed going forward. I think just like with the grand jury or how things are done, I think there's a difference between ethics and the way that people don't like how things are being handled. And that is something that we need to make sure that all avenues are explored to make sure that when there's things appropriate in regards to a grand jury, in regards to a judge, we need to have everything addressed. We need to make sure that there is transparency out there so that people know that when decisions are made or things are addressed, that it is being made in the best interest of the state of Alaska and its people. Did that answer your question?
Not quite exactly. I guess I'll rephrase the question. What role does the judiciary play in the function of the grand jury?
I will tell you what I believe the role that is being played is. That is something that is being addressed right now, because it's something where, just like when we are looking at judges or we are looking at trials, it is something that we are there to make sure that the ethics are followed and the process is followed. So I think in regards to the grand jury situation, there are things that are in the process of being determined right now in regards to how that has to be addressed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No further
questions. I mean, I know it's a really tough situation right now, and so it's something that I want to make sure that when we're looking at the current situation in regards to our responsibility with the grand jury, it is something that we are there to make sure that the proper process is filed and that we are following where we should be in that process taking place.
Representative Carpenter. Excuse me. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. To follow up on that, through the chair, I am curious if a member of the judiciary intervenes in the grand jury process and violates the rights of the grand jury. Is that conduct that the commission should be looking at? And if so, what's an appropriate sanction, if you will, for that kind of conduct?
You're saying if somebody from the commission gets involved?
No, my question is if a member of the judiciary takes action to violate the rights of a grand jury or a member of a grand jury, is that the type of conduct that the commission ought to look at? And if so, what might be an appropriate sanction?
Well, I will tell you that from my standpoint, I believe, yes, that is something that has to be looked at, because judges are supposed to be unbiased. And if there is involvement there that would question the ethics of their bias, that's where it is up to us, where we would go in and look with how it took place, what happened, and make the decision on what the proper sanction level would be. Because there's a couple different things that get determined, and that's a process in itself on how that has to be addressed, both from a private standpoint or a public standpoint. And we want to make sure that is followed correctly.
Okay.
Any further questions for Mr. Fletcher? Seeing none, thank you so much, Mr. Fletcher, for your willingness to serve and for coming before the committee today.
Well, I thank you all for your time, and I know the grand jury thing is a very big deal, and it's something that it does need to be addressed, and I look forward to being part of the process to make sure that anything that needs to be done in the best interest of the people and the state of Alaska, that it gets looked at so that people know that there is confidence in our system. So thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Finally, we will now take up the appointee to the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, Mr. William Bill Granger. Mr. Granger, if you can hear us, please state your name for the record and begin your remarks.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is William Granger. I am a lifelong Alaskan, and I am pleased and honored to have the governor reappoint me to the Alaska Bar Association Board of Governors. I've served on the Board of Governors for several years, many years, and have been appointed by several different governors. I'm also a lifelong banker. Started working for a little bank when I was in high school called Matanuska Valley Bank. Hence long gone, but retired from Wells Fargo Bank a few years ago, and been in the banking business my entire life, mainly a credit finance kind of person. And I have found that my role as a member of the Board of Governors is in part uses my training of financial management, and I find it to be very rewarding and important service to the public. I find that service to the public is a great thing to do, and certainly encourage everybody to find their niche somewhere. The public perspective as to the governance of the Bar Association, I think, is extremely important. We have three public members on the board at any given time, and their input is listened to and often is a deciding factor on how the board issues its determination to the rulings. So I appreciate being here, and welcome any questions you might have. Thanks.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Representative Eastman, through the chair. Mr. Granger, what is the term, the length of the term for which you've been appointed?
This would be a three-year term.
And so I understand from your resume that you've been on the board from 2000 to present, so three more years. That would be 26 years on the board. That's an awful lot of time. Thank you for your willingness to serve that long period of time. You know, I know we talk about things like term limits here on occasion. Why or how would you respond if someone said, you know, you shouldn't be on a board that long?
Sure, great question. So it's interesting that the Board of Governors turns over every 3 years. All the members. Whether they be public members or whether they be attorney elected members, the board management turns over every year. Hence, there is little institutional memory. And if you have turnover in management, executive directors, etc., you tend to lose a lot of that institutional memory. And even without that turnover, the institutional memory that you have is filtered through that management, unless there's somebody on the board that's been there long enough to know what has happened in the past. So I think institutional memory is a very good reason for a person to serve multiple terms on boards that are structured similar to the Alaska Bar Association.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Follow-up.
And how are the other, the non-publicly appointed members of the board, how are they chosen every 3 years?
Yeah, it's a popular vote by the judicial district the member would reside in. There is a member at large. There is a non-voting new lawyer liaison person. So they're basically chosen from the approximate 4,700 total members that we have, about 2,200 or so active members in various judicial districts. So there's representation from all the judicial districts and the member at large.
Follow. And through the chair, now the districting that determines those non-public member boards. Do you know the last time that districting was reapportioned or redistricted for population changes throughout the state?
I do not. I believe there is a person from the South Central area, a person from the Fairbanks area, and a person from Southeast. I think that's generally the balance that's tried to be followed. It may depend on you know, the availability of people willing to serve. I'm not sure.
I know there's been some discussion in our committee in the past over the population in the second judicial district and how that does not line up now with the population in the second judicial district. I think I don't have the date off the top, but I believe the last time redistricting took place for the board was, I'm in my 40s. It was sometime before I was born. And I'm just wondering, is there discussion on the board, or do you have any thoughts on whether or not that allocation should be changed? I know it's currently in statute, so it requires us as a legislature to take action, but should it be updated for population changes?
Well, I think population changes are certainly the major driving factor for apportioning anything like that. I have not personally studied the demographic changes in the second judicial district to that extent, but I would agree that the representation should follow the geography of the population.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Granger? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Granger, thank you again for being here. Thank you for your service. And I've got another question regarding the code of conduct that the Alaska Bar Association has. What is the role of the board in the evaluation or revision of the code of conduct?
The code of conduct of whom?
I'm sorry, sir. Was that a question back to me?
Yeah, I'm just not sure who you're asking. What is the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association's role in the code of conduct for who?
The Alaska Bar Association members.
Well, the members of our bar association are governed by the rules of the court, and the bylaws of the association. We are one of our duties is a disciplinary duty, and we do fulfill that role regularly and evaluating whether an attorney has acted properly and responsibly and ethically according to the rules of conduct of the court.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Since you have been on the board for a number of years, I wonder if you would characterize for me, and this is just a ballpark figure, how many cases a year, how many allegations a year, I guess you could say, how many instances where there is a disciplinary investigation happen within the Alaska system here with regard to complaints on attorneys that the board would have to evaluate?
The board's role in disciplinary matters is basically reviewing and affirming or tweaking the recommendations and rulings that come from a disciplinary panel. And those matters are brought to the disciplinary panel by a small group of attorneys within the association that would conduct investigations on complaints that they might receive. The last couple of years, the number of disciplinary matters brought to the board, in my view, has declined quite a bit. I think that's a good thing, because I think it shows that we have established, you know, a pretty good understanding with our body as to what's expected for them to function in a responsible and ethical manner. But the Board of Governors receives these rulings and recommendations from a disciplinary panel. We review them to determine whether we believe them, their recommendations to be appropriate. And then we would pass our recommendation on to the Supreme Court for their ruling.
One follow-up?
Follow-up?
Sir, if you were to characterize the number of times that this that you have to address the cases brought to you, would it be 10 a year, 100 a year, or 1,000 a year?
From the board seat, it would be certainly less than 10, maybe 6 or 8.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Gray, thanks for being here. My question is about the recent lowering of the Alaska bar, the minimum score needed to pass from 280 to 270. Do you have an opinion about that decision?
Yes, I do. I actually voted against that. I think I was the only member in the bar that voted in the Board of Governors that voted against it. I believe that our educational system across the country is letting us down from, you know, grade school on up, even on through law school. Our law examiners that grade the tests tell us that the quality of the writings, has been deteriorating. And, I believe that, that lowering our cut score just, brought us down, a notch from excellence. Now, obviously, most of my peers disagreed with me, but, those were my feelings.
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair, what do you think will be the result? My understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, was one of the reasons they did that is they thought that then we would have more lawyers in Alaska. I guess, A, do you think that will result in more attorneys in Alaska? And B, I mean, I assume from your first answer that you think that we might end up with less great attorneys in Alaska.
Yeah, the last part of your question kind of cut out there, but yeah, I believe that it will increase the number of lawyers licensed to practice in Alaska. I think lawyers follow the money and the activity in general. At one point, we had more lawyers per capita than anywhere in the nation except Washington, D.C. And, you know, I think today's level of lawyers, numbers wise is a little on the low side, but it's probably more because of the attraction of, the work and the payment for that work and the illegal activity that's going on in the state. But certainly that was a point to lowering the cut score, that it would allow more people to be admitted to the bar. And I believe that we are seeing some of that happen today. Now, whether those people actually end up practicing in Alaska or not, I don't know.
Any further questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Appreciate your willingness to serve. Do you know if Alaska has reciprocity with other states? And which other states, or how many, and in terms of you're accepted in Alaska, you get a license someplace else?
Well, generally speaking, yes, although I can't be specific. We do have reciprocity with many other states. We don't with California, for example. I don't think they have reciprocity with anyone. I think maybe Louisiana falls in that same bucket. But we certainly do have reciprocity with many, many other states. And as long as you have taken a UBE and passed with a score that's satisfactory to us, then you can apply and go through the process to become a member of the Alaska Bar.
Thank you, Manager.
Oh, and, you know, if for example, you practice in another state for a period of years, I think it's 5 years, and don't have any issues, you can also apply to be a member of the Alaska Bar regardless of your test score.
Thank you, Mr. Granger. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. I just wondered, kind of relates to the question about, you know, bar passage rates and scores and such. It's been a long time since Alaska had a law school, I think forever. And I'm wondering if that's something you think should change.
Oh, I think it would be wonderful to see a law school in Alaska. My son is a lawyer, and, you know, he went outside the school because he had to. But, you know, I think he probably would have done that anyway. But yeah, I think a law school in Alaska would be a great thing. We have had some partnerships with law schools in Washington State in the past, but it's demographically difficult to run a law school in Alaska. You know, the numbers of people, it hasn't penciled out very well, and there just hasn't seemed to be a lot of initiative for that to happen. But it would be great to see a law school in Alaska.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Granger? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Granger, for your willingness to serve and answering the questions from committee members today.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
Let me take a brief at ease. Back on the record, I would now like to open public testimony on the three governor's appointees. And seeing there is does anyone in the room like to testify? Now we'll now go to online. We have Mr. David Ignell. If you would please state your name for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Yeah, this is David Ignell. A recording came on when you were announcing. Did you want me to talk now?
Oh, yes. Please state your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes to testify on any of the three appointments.
Okay, I have testimony for all three of them, so I guess what I'll do is I'll start with William Granger. I can't do this in 2 minutes, but just cut me off when you want me to stop talking. Good afternoon, Chair Vance and members of the committee. My name is David Ignell. I'm a forensic journalist who resides in Juneau. My writing focuses on systemic injustice here in Alaska, my birthplace. 4 years ago, my investigation into the wrongful conviction of Thomas Jack Jr. began to open my eyes to the Alaska Supreme Court's disregard of our constitutional rights. It's egregious how easily our legal system sent an innocent and good man to jail for 50 years when a mountain of credible evidence pointed to a false accusation. Other miscarriages of justice have been brought to my attention since then. Once proud to be an Alaskan, today I'm left disgusted and embarrassed. A few months ago, our Supreme Court was at it again. All five judges approved Order 1993, which thought citizen-requested grand jury investigations into concerns of government misconduct. It was a grotesquely unconstitutional order, which suggests our unelected judges think they also hold legislative power. We, the people, must draw a line in the sand and say no more. We must begin to closely scrutinize every single factor which produces judges who show blatant disregard for our Constitution and make up their own laws. One of those factors is the Alaska Bar Association. Under the Constitution, the ABA appoints the three attorneys who sit on the Alaska Judicial Council. We the people are completely in the dark as to how these appointments are determined. This committee has previously heard testimony that prospective judges who believe in upholding the Constitution no longer apply for judicial openings because they know it's a waste of time. With your confirmation power, you can begin to put an end to this madness. The ABA is also responsible for investigating ethical violations. I'm aware of several ethical violations by our state lawyers, past and ongoing, where nothing has been done about it. For instance, in Mr. Jack's case, critical evidence of a false accusation was withheld by prosecutors from the grand jury twice. This was a constitutional violation, yet the system looked the other way and eventually rewarded the prosecutors. The ABA handles all ethical complaints behind closed doors, but it's even worse. Anyone who files a complaint is threatened with contempt of court if they discuss a complaint or even notify others that they have filed one. Why should allegations of ethical violations be handled secretly by the ABA while allegations of criminal conduct are handled out in the open in our courts? Why do ABA members deserve preferential treatment over citizens? Democracy dies in such darkness. It's time the doors to the ABA back rooms are opened wide to the public. All proceedings and deliberations should be televised. All votes should be made public. We the people are allowed 3 members of the public to be on the ABA's Board of Governors. It's imperative each of these 3 members start sticking up for us. Tell us what is going on behind those closed doors and work to get things out into the open. Demand transparency.
In all fairness, I'm going, because there are 3 separate appointees, I'm going to give you 2 minutes for each appointee. You've gone for your first 2 minutes. So if I will set the alarm for the next 2 minutes so that you can transition to the next.
Okay. I will then start on Dennis DeWitt for the Alaska Judicial Council. And I have submitted written comments, so I'll each comment starts out with the same preface. So I will just skip down to the next factor, which is the Alaska Judicial Council, which determines which judicial candidates are nominated for the governor's selection. We the people are almost completely in the dark regarding the basis of their nominations. Transparency is next to nothing. Interviews are done privately. Deliberations are done behind closed doors where no one is accountable for public testimony. Consider the travesty committed by the council in Kenai back in January for a judicial vacancy. At least 20 citizens gave public testimony, and at least 90% of those were there to support one candidate. Well, after thanking us for showing up and giving testimony, the council closed its doors and stabbed us in the back. They emerged with a list of 4 nominations, and not one of those was the people's choice. We desperately need public members of the council to promote transparency. We want to know exactly why the council is not nominating the candidates we want. Regarding Mr. DeWitt, he's been an acquaintance of mine here in Juneau for the last year. I don't know him well. We've spoken briefly just a couple of times. Mutual friends of ours say he's inclined to stand up for what's right. That's a start, but there's more required of him for such an important position. Mr. DeWitt needs to walk into the council on day 1 and remove all the doors. It's time to get rid of the pomp and circumstance that surrounds our judicial selections. If Mr. DeWitt gets resistance from other council members, then he must be willing to go public with everything he witnesses. We the people have the absolute right to know what's going on in our government so that we can hold officials accountable. Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution says that all political power is inherent in the people. All government originates with the people, is founded upon their will only, and is instituted solely for the good of the people as a whole. For our will to be implemented properly, we the people need to know what is going on in our government. Transparency and accountability are essential. If Mr. DeWitt pledges to pull out all the stops in accomplishing these goals and push for judges that will uphold the Constitution, then I will support his confirmation. The freedom of an innocent man in jail for the last 13 years may ultimately depend on him. That's all I have to say on Mr. DeWitt. I will now go over to Todd Fletcher for Commission on Judicial Conduct. Again, the same preface, and let me go about four paragraphs down and say, one of those factors is the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Under the Constitution, the Commission has the power to recommend the disqualification, suspension, removal, or censure of any judge or justice in the state. Their ability to determine what constitutes judicial misconduct is a powerful tool that is not being used properly today. For starters, the Commission needs better transparency. All matters should be deliberated in full public view. In their most recent online meeting, the camera revealed only about half of the members, and some of those had their backs to the camera. They should conduct the meeting in a setting where each member is identified and the public can see and hear all of them. Next, the Commission needs to start demonstrating that they actually care about the public. At the last meeting, many citizens waited for over an hour and a half for the opportunity to speak, and then were rudely prevented from speaking by Chairman Roteman. He acted like a dictator and unilaterally cut us off. It was appalling. From what I could tell, Mr. Fletcher allowed him to do this and didn't stick up for the public. Afterwards, the Commission attempted to excuse the chairman's behavior by saying public speakers needed to register 48 hours in advance. That's absurd. It's not done in the Capitol, and it's not done in local assembly meetings. What gives them the right to act so special? Next, I've heard multiple concerns about the executive director of the commission not properly handling judicial complaints. The public needs more transparency in the entire investigation process. Complaints should not be handled in the dark. When complaints of a serious nature are alleged, the commission should request investigations by grand juries led by completely independent special prosecutors who don't need to fear repercussions from the judiciary. Let grand juries use their special common law powers to be the finders of facts. Make grand jury reports public and then make your deliberations about their recommendations public. Next, what's the commission's policy in dealing with conflicts of interest? I've spoken to Alaska lawyers who are afraid to speak up about judges for fear of retaliation against them and their clients. There's a real concern that that could preclude all three attorney members from participating in complaints against judges.
Thank you, Mr. Ignell. And we have received your written testimony. And for the public, if you would like to send your written testimony, you can send to house.judiciary@akleg.gov. We have now heard. I will close public testimony on the governor's appointments. We've now heard from all of the appointees from the governors on three different boards and commissions. And in accordance with AS 39.05.080, the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on the following appointees. Alaska Judicial Council, Dennis DeWitt. Commission on Judicial Conduct, Todd Fletcher. Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, William Granger. And a signature on this report does not reflect any intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of individuals during any further sessions. I would ask that members please stick around after adjournment to sign the report. That concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Monday, April 17th at 1 p.m. to continue our work on House Bill 68, Crime of Sex and Human Trafficking by the Governor, as presented by the Department of Law. As a reminder, all amendments to the recent committee substitute are due to my office by 5 p.m. today. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect, it is 2:48 p.m.